When a regime, when a country takes decisions which takes away the lives of other people unjustly, then obviously that is something that should be condemned.
Strong comments from Pope Leo XIV as he returns home from his apostolic journey to Africa. The trip focused on pastoral teaching to the people he met there, with overall themes of justice and peace for all of us. Never forget, thousands flocked to the tomb of Pope Francis on this first anniversary of his death. Our expert panel joins us to discuss both Francis and Leo, the legacy of one and the promise of the other.
What is your message to the Archdiocese of Chicago?
You don't want that on camera.
Really?
And we talked to Chicago parishioners upset about the closure of their church, one of many around the country sitting empty or repurposed because of church consolidation. We examine an often emotional issue with no easy answers. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
I condemn all actions that are unjust. I condemn the taking of people's lives. I condemn capital punishment. I believe that human life is to be respected and that all people from conception to natural birth, their lives should be respected and protected.
A message of justice and peace from Pope Leo XIV at the conclusion of his papal visit to Africa, in which he visited four countries over 11 days, reaching out to millions of faithful on a continent where Catholicism is experiencing its largest growth. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. The marathon papal journey has been the longest yet of Pope Leo's pontificate. In a visit overshadowed by global conflict and politics, the Holy Father doubled down on his message of peace. In a wide-ranging in-flight press conference on his way back to Rome from Africa, Pope Leo reflected on his trip and gave some of his strongest and clearest comments yet on war. The Holy Father answered questions from several reporters, including a few about the conflict between the U.S. and Iran, which he has been particularly vocal about. He emphasized that leaders must remember the human toll of war and promote their values without the deaths of so many innocent people.
Porto con me una foto di un bambino.
I carry with me a photo of a Muslim child who, during my visit to Lebanon, was standing there holding a sign that said, "Welcome Pope Leo." And in this latest phase of the war, he was killed. There are many human situations like this, and I believe we must have the ability to think in this way. And as a church, I say again, as a pastor, I cannot be in favor of war.
Those comments come less than a week after Pope Leo spoke out against media coverage during his trip to Africa over an apparent back and forth with President Donald Trump over the war in Iran. Some suggested that one of his speeches in Cameroon, in which he spoke of the world's tyrants, was aimed at Trump. But last Saturday, Pope Leo shut down that narrative, saying he has no interest in debating the president.
Much of what has been written since then has been more commentary on commentary, trying to interpret what has been said. Just one little example, the talk that I gave at the prayer meeting for peace a couple days ago was prepared 2 weeks ago, well before the president ever commented on myself and on the message of peace that I am promoting. And yet, as it happens, it was looked at as if I was trying to debate again the president, which is not my interest at all.
Just as the apostolic journey began, Trump blasted the Holy Father for his criticisms of the conflict in Iran, calling him weak on crime in a social media post. In response, Pope Leo told reporters he had, quote, no fear of the Trump administration and would continue to preach the gospel of peace. The crowds were huge in Africa to hear Pope Leo preach that gospel of peace. Everywhere he went, he was greeted with fanfare and joy on this, his first apostolic visit to the Global South. With key moments from the trip, EWTN News foreign correspondent Colin Flynn picks up where he left off on this program last week at about the halfway point of Pope Leo's journey.
La paix soit avec vous.
Et avec votre esprit. Pope Leo XIV's apostolic journey in Africa continued this week with great excitement from the African people. On Saturday, April the 18th, the Holy Father concluded his visit to Cameroon, where more than 200,000 people had gathered for Mass in Yaoundé to bid farewell. And in his homily, he urged the people to fight against inequality and injustice.
L'Église camerounaise est vivante.
The church in Cameroon is alive, young, rich in gifts and enthusiasm, vibrant in its diversity and wonderful in its harmony.
These were his final words to the people of Cameroon.
We pray that before Pope leaves Cameroon, he should find a solution to the Anglophone crisis. That is our only cry.
Starting this journey in Algeria and then going to Cameroon, Pope Leo next flew to the third country of his four-country trip, the nation of Angola in West Africa. Landing in Luanda, the Angolan capital, he was welcomed with singing, dancing, and a very enthusiastic crowd. Angola is a country rich in natural resources, but which still carries the scars of war, poverty, and decades of hardship. And historically, Angola was one of the major hubs in the slave trade industry. And at the presidential palace, Pope Leo met with President Juan Manuel González Lorenzo before addressing authorities and members of the diplomatic corps. And in a country where the Catholic Church plays a major role in education and healthcare, the Pope called for public life to be guided not by power or profit, but by service to the common good. The following day, Sunday, Pope Leo celebrated Mass in Kalamba, outside Luanda, with a huge crowd of over 200,000 faithful gathered.
The country is longing for peace, for hope, and for change.
And in his homily, he reminded Angolans that the joy of Easter is not abstract.
Carissimos, a boa nova do Senhor.
Dear friends, the good news of the Lord, even for us today, is precisely this. He is alive, he is risen, and he walks beside us.
Later that day, Pope Leo traveled to Muxima, one of Angola's best-known Marian pilgrimage sites. The shrine, whose name comes from the Kimbundu word for heart, has for generations been a place where Angolans have brought both their joys and their pain. Built by the Portuguese in 1599, it has also lived through some of the darkest chapters of Angola's history and remains a place of deep national devotion.
Here, for a long time now, Mama Muxima has quietly worked to keep the heart of the church alive and beating.
Muxima si empenha de forma discreta a manter vivo e pulsante o coração da igreja.
On Monday, Pope Leo flew nearly 1,000 kilometers northeast to Sorimo in Angola's Lunda Sul province, a region that is known internationally for its diamonds. But here too, the Pope focused his attention on those who were pushed to the margins. His first stop was a government-run home for the elderly, known simply as LAR, meaning home. The residence cares for more than 60 elderly people, and Pope Leo used the visit to underline a theme that he has returned to often on this trip, that a society is judged by how it treats its weakest members. From there, the Pope went to the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Assumption, where tens of thousands had gathered for Mass in the open air. And in his homily, Pope Leo spoke directly to a people who know poverty, exploitation all too well, saying that Christ hears their cries.
In the face of these evils, Christ hears the cry of the people and renews our history by lifting us up from every fall, comforting us in every suffering, and encouraging us in our mission.
On Thursday morning, Pope Leo bid farewell to Angola and flew the 8-hour flight to Equatorial Guinea, the fourth and final stop of this African journey. At the presidential palace, the Pope met with President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo, who has ruled the country since 1979. And in his first public address there, Pope Leo XIV condemned what he called the colonization of Africa's mineral resources and the lust for power.
In a world wounded by arrogance, people hunger and thirst for justice. It is necessary to encourage those who believe in peace and to dare to engage in countercurrent politics, those which place the common good at their very center.
Later, he visited a psychiatric hospital where he spoke against the stigma surrounding mental illness and praised the work carried out by the carers. Wednesday was Pope Leo's final full day in Africa and one of the busiest of the entire trip. In the morning, he flew from the city of Malabo to the town of Mongomo, where he celebrated Mass at the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, an enormous church inspired by St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. And in his homily, he thanked the Lord for 170 years of evangelization in Equatorial Guinea.
Así, hermanos, hermanas,
and told the faithful that the future of the country would depend on the choices they make now.
Brothers and sisters, even when faced with personal, family, and social situations that are not always favorable, we can trust that the Lord is at work, making the good seed of His kingdom grow in ways unknown to us, including when everything around us seems barren, and even in moments of darkness.
Finally, the Pope traveled to Bata, the country's largest city and main port on the mainland. His first stop there was a local prison. He met with inmates, staff and prison chaplains. And in his speech to them, he insisted that no one is excluded from God's love and that justice must not simply be punishment, but it should also help rebuild lives.
Although prison may seem like a lonely and desolate place, as has been said, it can also become a space for reflection, reconciliation, and personal growth. Every effort should be made to ensure that you are given the opportunity to study and to work with dignity while in prison. There is always the possibility to start over, learn, and become a new person.
And then, as the day drew to a close, came one of the most joyful moments of the entire journey, the meeting with young people and families in Bata Stadium. And on Thursday, the final day of this apostolic journey, Pope Leo celebrated his last Mass in Africa at the Malabo Stadium, where around 30,000 faithful had gathered for the liturgy.
My name is Samuel Adizu from Nigeria. In Nigeria, there's crisis, there's problem there. Papa will not come to Nigeria. That is why I come to have the blessing.
And in his homily, the Pope returned to one of the central themes of this entire trip.
If you are oppressed by injustice, He is justice. If you are in need of help, He is strength. If you fear death, He is life. If you desire heaven, He is the way. If you are in darkness, He is light.
At the end of the Mass, Pope Leo said goodbye to Africa, thanking the people he had met across Algeria, Cameroon, Angola, and Equatorial Guinea. He had said that he had come on this trip as a pilgrim of peace, and it is hoped that that message of peace will be heard and make a difference in these countries that have been so marked by violence, war, corruption, suffering, and inequality over the decades.
Our problems do not disappear in the Lord's presence, but they are illuminated. Just as every cross finds redemption in Jesus, so too the story of our lives find its meaning in the gospel.
Reporting on the conclusion of Pope Leo XIV's trip to Africa, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
On the papal plane back to Rome from Africa, our Holy Father emphasized to reporters on board that his apostolic journey is primarily pastoral and not political.
il viaggio è.
The journey should be understood above all as an expression of the desire to proclaim the gospel, to announce the message of Jesus Christ, which is a way of drawing close to the people in their happiness, in the depth of their faith, but also in their suffering.
To discuss the Holy Father's apostolic journey to Africa, the news headlines from the trip and the papal plane presser and more, we are joined now by two voices who closely follow the life of the church. Paloma Garcia Ovejero previously worked as a journalist before making history as the first woman to serve as deputy director of the Holy See Press Office under Pope Francis. She's now the head of media and editorial at Mary's Meals International. Jonathan Liedl is managing editor of our EWTN news service, the National Catholic Register, where he provides extensive reporting and analysis on Catholicism and on the pontificate of Pope Leo XIV. Thank you both for being here. Jonathan, I want to start with you. The start of this apostolic journey to Africa was dominated by headlines about President Trump's criticism of the Holy Father's comments on peace. How did Pope Leo navigate that, and did he successfully bring the faithful's focus back to his mission in Africa?
Well, you're right. The eve before Pope Leo was set to embark to Africa, we saw President Trump criticized the Pope on social media and in interview comments for TV. Pope Leo responded the next day, but I think it's really important to note that he didn't go out of his way to respond. He was asked a question by a journalist on the plane if he feared the Trump administration. So his response saying, no, I don't fear the administration and I don't fear speaking the gospel was already an effort for him to bring the focus not on politics, but back to this pastoral visit that we're talking about. There was another important moment on the trip too, where Pope Leo actually addressed the journalists on the plane after a number of articles had been written suggesting that that statements Pope Leo made during this trip to Africa, where he would condemn war, where he would criticize those who invoke God to justify war. A number of articles have been written suggesting he was saying that about Donald Trump. Pope Leo said these speeches were written 2 weeks ago, right? And so he continually brought the focus back to Africa, back to the people of Africa, the church in Africa, the faith in Africa, and the issues affecting people on the continent. And so I think Americans, that song, you know, you're so vain, you probably think this song is about you, maybe plays out sometimes, but Pope Leo, his focus was on the people in Africa here.
Paloma, as Jonathan just mentioned, last Saturday, Pope Leo did directly address that media narrative about him and President Trump and said his speeches in Africa, again, they were written weeks prior and they were tailored to his specific audience, not about the U.S. president. Paloma, what did you make of how Pope Leo addressed that? And overall, how would you describe how he's engaging with the press?
I would say the mystery is over. For months, almost 1 year, press has said, who is this Pope? What is he thinking? And there were many articles about the silent Pope. Now, we all have discovered that he's not afraid of microphones. He's not avoiding questions at all, but he's facing the truth and he's facing the attacks or the breaking news with such a natural attitude that is the surprise. I could say this is the very first title. Pope Francis was a phenomenal communicator. Pope Leo has an inner talent to talk about anything with anyone.
That's a really interesting observation. Jonathan, let's dig into this Africa trip now. Was there a specific moment that stood out to you the most? I mean, his visit with prisoners in Equatorial Guinea was especially moving.
Yeah, you're right, Catherine. Four countries and so many different encounters with people, so many beautiful moments. But I think the one you just mentioned, this encounter with prisoners in Equatorial Guinea, was really striking to me to see the Holy Father, the Vicar of Christ, going and meeting and being with men serving time for sometimes violent crimes. There was one moment in particular that I saw that really moved me. It was seeing a prisoner clad in, you know, the orange of a prison uniform, kneeling down and kissing the papal ring of Pope Leo. And it struck me because it was so incarnational, right? The incarnation, the infinite becoming finite, God becoming man. And here we see this moment where Pope Leo, The man is so close to this man, seeking the mercy of God, seeking closeness to God, and at the same time, Pope Leo, you know, maintaining his role as the vicar of Christ. So that beautiful closeness and transcendence there, which I think is, quite honestly, as I've watched him over this near year in his pontificate, has been such a hallmark of his, both this closeness to people while also maintaining, I think, in some ways, the significance of his role as the vicar of Christ. Just one final thought, too, is this was the first long international papal trip of Pope Leo's own initiative. He's been, of course, to Turkey, and then Lebanon, but that trip, at least to Turkey, was already on the books. This is the first major papal trip that he's chosen the itinerary of. And I think the fact that he chose to go to Africa, a place where the church is growing, but there are also many challenges, I think is really indicative of his desire to be close to those people and to be a shepherd of the universal church.
So many moments packed into those 11 days. Paloma, on the flight to Africa, journalists presented Pope Leo with a Mary's Meals t-shirt and mug, and that's the global charity that you work for. And Mary's Meals serves more than 2.5 million children in Africa alone. Paloma, tell us, how urgent is the plight of food insecurity in Africa right now, and how did Pope Leo address this directly during his apostolic journey?
When Pope Leo received that mug and the journalists told him, this is what they do, feeding children at school, it costs just $25 per year. $25 per year to feed a child the whole school year. So the first reaction was, he knew Mary's Meals, and of course that made not only my day, but it meant the world for our volunteers and donors and supporters. But when the fifth day, he said in the middle of the homily about Jesus and the hungry, he said, what will you do? We all must help to address the hunger in the world. What will you do? Was the question he addressed to the African people in Africa. And it means he knows, as he explained it, no one should be hungry. There is food for everyone, as Pope Francis said so many times, also to Mary's Meals founder, Magnus McFarlane Barrow, when he was with him. There is food for everyone, but it's not happening. What will you do? And it really struck me, because it's not Pope Leo saying this in the UN.
Jonathan, on the plane back to Rome on Thursday, Pope Leo responded to a reporter's question on Cardinal Reinhard Marx, the Archbishop of Munich and Freising in Germany, who this week instructed priests to facilitate blessings for same-sex couples. Here's part of the Holy Father's response.
The Holy See has already spoken to the German bishops. The Holy See has made it clear that we do not agree with the formalized blessing of couples, in this case homosexual couples, as you ask, or couples in irregular situations, beyond what was specifically, allowed for by Pope Francis in saying all people receive blessings.
Jonathan, what more should we know about this developing story in Germany, and how significant are Pope Leo's comments there?
Well, this is just part of a continued push of some Catholic leaders in Germany for these formalized blessings and, you know, part of the synodal way. And as Pope Leo said, the church has already spoken. The church has already spoken on this. He emphasized, he repeated Pope Francis's emphasis on totus, totus, totus. Everyone is welcome, but everyone is welcome to pursue Christ, to seek conversion. And I think it's really important. He ended his response to this by emphasizing unity. He said, this is not good for the unity of the church, this push. And instead, he said, we should look for opportunities to build church unity by focusing on Jesus Christ and the teachings of Jesus Christ. So we'll have to wait and see if there's any further response from Pope Leo on what we're seeing in Germany.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both so much. And both stay right there. We'll pick up our next conversation very soon. There is much more on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. When we come back, our focus remains on the papacy as our conversation turns to Pope Francis on this one-year anniversary of his passing.
Yes, every time I walk past his grave, the memories come flooding back.
because you can't forget a pope like that.
1 year after the death of Pope Francis, thousands of pilgrims still come to pray every day at his tomb in Rome's St. Mary Major Basilica. Our panel returns to discuss his legacy and to share some personal stories of what it was like to work with him. The Supreme Court takes up a Colorado case that will impact whether public funds should be used to help finance Catholic preschools.
We want to make it like a shrine where we can come and pray. We know that it can no longer be a church.
And later, St. Adalbert's Catholic Church, beloved in Chicago, yet shuttered for 7 years. Next, what faithful members are doing to keep the spirit of their parish alive. EWTN News in Depth will be right back.
His exhortations still echo in our ears, expressed in eloquent words to make the good news ever more understandable.
Remembering the life of our late pontiff, on Tuesday, hundreds gathered at the Basilica of St. Mary Major in Rome to commemorate the first year anniversary of the death of Pope Francis. Before Mass, the faithful prayed a rosary in front of Salus Populi Romani, a Marian icon that Pope Francis was so devoted to, he asked to be laid to rest next to its chapel. All day, crowds came to pay their respects at his tomb, a humble marble slab that simply bears the name Franciscus. It was 1 year ago this week the world said goodbye to Pope Francis. Born Jorge Mario Bergoglio in Buenos Aires, Argentina in 1936, he shepherded the Universal Church for more than a decade.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buona Pasqua.
On Easter Sunday 2025, the Holy Father would make his final public appearance, giving the annual Urbi et Orbi blessing and greeting St. Peter's crowds from his Pope Mobile. Just 1 day later, to the shock of the faithful around the world, he was born into eternal life. Thousands lined the streets of Rome to say farewell as his coffin was carried to the Basilica of St. Mary Major. In honor of the anniversary of his predecessor's passing, Pope Leo XIV reflected on the late pontiff's legacy of gospel simplicity and mercy while aboard the papal plane during his Africa trip.
His actions so often reflected in what he did, truly embodied closeness to the poorest, the smallest, the sick, children, and the elderly. He gave so much to the church through his testimony and his message. Let us pray that he is already enjoying the mercy of the Lord, and we thank the Lord for the great gift of the life of Francis to the church and the world.
A pope of firsts, Francis made history as the first successor of St. Peter to be from the Americas, the first from the Jesuit order, and the first to take the name Francis. He was also known as a pope of the peripheries, seeking to bring the gospel to those on the margins of society and envisioning a church that chooses pastoral engagement over clericalism. To discuss the legacy of Pope Francis with the perspective of 1 year since his death, we are rejoined by our panel. Paloma Garcia Ovejero is the former deputy director of the Holy See Press Office under Pope Francis, and our EWTN News colleague, National Catholic Register Managing Editor Jonathan Liedl. Thank you both for being back with us now. Paloma, I'm going to start with you here, because as we just said, you served directly under Pope Francis and the Holy See Press Office. Tell us, what was he like?
He was a man with a faith that could move mountains. He was a happy man, and he had an astonishing sense of humor, even in the worst moments, in the most difficult crisis. He always made you laugh. Mm. He really talked to the Holy Spirit before making decisions. And he knew God was in charge, is in charge. Pope Francis is alive. I can tell you, he's still listening to people in Santa Maria Maggiore. He moved to Santa Maria from Santa Marta. Mm-hmm. And I bet he's having fun. He's having fun being again a priest. He never left his priest heart, his priest mercy, his priest ear. Pope Francis happened to be a pope, but he really had the joy of the gospel, and it was contagious.
Thank you for sharing those personal reflections. Jonathan, what will Pope Francis's legacy be defined by?
Yeah, I think Pope Francis's legacy, really, he was a pope who wanted people to encounter Christ, right? And at the same time, he was also willing to shake up the church, shake up a sense of complacency, and to shake up those things that I think he thought got in the way of that encounter with Christ. We've already seen the images you played, those iconic moments of him, you know, I think of him washing the feet of prisoners, him hugging a disfigured man in St. Peter's Square, of course, holding the Eucharist, holding Christ up during the midst of the COVID pandemic. I think this was at the heart of who he was and what he wanted to give to the church. And, you know, he used this phrase, Hagen Leo, early on in his papacy, which meant make a mess. And I think he really saw, you know, whether it was clericalism or whether a fixation overly focused on the moral teachings of the church, he saw those as maybe things that get in the way of that encounter with Christ sometimes. He had a style that was more personal than sort of procedural. And, I think it's fair to say that his pontificate was one that was disruptive, right? In some ways, shaking things up, shaking the status quo up. And we're still making sense of what that means and where to go from here. But I think that was really at the heart of what was animating him, was that desire for people to encounter Christ.
Mm. Paloma, how did Pope Francis's Argentinian background in particular shape his approach to leading the church?
That's a very good question. If you want me to be honest, he left behind his past, his background. Of course, he was from Argentina, but I think Jorge Mario Bergoglio died in 2013, and Pope Francis, Papa Francesco, was born that night at St. Peter's with no land and no roots in human terms. He became a man for tutti, 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 all, as everyone knows, including Pope Leo. And I couldn't say it affected. I mean, his Argentinian origin affected his pontificate more than, of course, his close friends or his accent when he spoke Spanish. But he was very careful to be a man for all seasons.
Jonathan, there are a number of memorable phrases that Pope Francis repeated throughout his papacy. For example, in thinking of a shepherd must smell of their flock and his call for us to avoid a, quote, throwaway culture. Can you speak in brief to the spiritual themes of the Francis pontificate? What was his emphasis?
I think missionary discipleship was really the heart of his own approach to being a Catholic and what he tried to share with the church. And that is, we encounter Christ, and that encounter with Christ inspires us, moves us, forces us to go out to the margins and serve. And I think missionary discipleship, that emphasis was one of the greatest contributions he made to the church.
Now, Paloma, I have to ask, Pope Francis frequently delivered unscripted and off-the-cuff remarks, was known for spontaneous conversational style with improvised comments at times, which did make global headlines here and there. Can you share some insight and behind the scenes of what that was like from your role in the Holy See press office? Did you feel the need to manage our Holy Father's approach with the media?
Well, it was never a dull day, never a boring moment, especially when he was traveling. But at the same time, let me tell you, he was happy to step back, to apologize, and to amend his own comments when he realized he had made a big mistake. In the press office, behind that, let's say it's a 24/7 nonstop pontificate, but always a privilege. And you know what? When media criticized, when, you know, all these things that happened, all those crises, at the end of the day, it could happen also in Jesus Christ's times. So who cares? It's about God and the Holy Spirit and the Church and the Pope who is in charge.
Sounds like he kept you busy. Thank you for sharing that. Jonathan, in our final moment, what impact did Pope Francis have on the 2025 conclave and ultimately the election of Pope Leo XIV? How did his papacy lead to the start of this new papacy that we're now in?
Pope Francis really shaped the consistory, the College of Cardinals. He brought in, made it far more global. And then even more importantly than that, he really, in many ways, made Pope Leo a part of that consistory. He, of course, if you think of his career, he made Pope Leo a bishop in Chiclayo. They'd known each other before. He made Pope Leo the prefect of the Dicastery of Bishops, and then he made him a cardinal. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, you know, there's obviously some sense of continuity there. And I think, yes, as Pope Leo leads the church forward, in many ways, I think Francis's legacy will be defined to some extent by what Pope Leo does now, because mm-hmm. there are issues, whether it's the Synod on Synodality, whether it's this question of blessings and fiducia supplicans that Francis began. And I think Leo is really going to kind of define and make clear what these things actually mean for the life of the church mm-hmm. going forward. So a clear connection between the two for sure.
Paloma and Jonathan, so grateful for your reflections this week. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And next week, you will see Jonathan again when he presents a one-hour news special in this time slot. Jonathan takes us on a journey to Peru to talk to the people who knew a young missionary priest named Father Bob, who years later would become Bishop Robert Prevost in a Peruvian diocese. We will walk in the footsteps of the bishop to the cities he frequented and to the churches he prayed in and talk to the people who knew he was a very special priest long before he became Pope Leo XIV. An EWTN News documentary, Pope Leo's Peru, airs next Friday, May 1st at 8 p.m. Eastern with an encore presentation on Sunday at 11 a.m. You don't want to miss it. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. President Donald Trump's decision to extend a shaky ceasefire between the United States and Iran indefinitely tops the Week in Review. With less than a day before the expiration on Wednesday of the two-week ceasefire, Trump said it would be extended until Iran's leaders can, quote, come up with a unified proposal. But with tensions rising over the Strait of Hormuz, a choke point for one-fifth of the world's oil, negotiations remain at an impasse. Just a day after Trump announced the ceasefire's extension, Iranian forces attacked three cargo ships in the strait and captured two of them in retaliation for the U.S. naval blockade on Iran's ports. Tehran says it would neither reopen the strait nor return to the negotiating table until the U.S. ends a naval blockade of Iranian ports. But Trump has said he will not end the blockade until a deal is made with Iran. Trump has also said he ordered the Navy to work at breakneck speed to sweep mines from the strait and ordered the Navy to, quote, shoot and kill any boat laying mines. Retired Army General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO Europe, says the U.S. military faces an array of obstacles in attempting to reopen the strait.
People talk about the mines, but it's the mines, the speedboats, the missiles, the sea skimming missiles, the cruise missiles, the ballistic missiles, the possible artillery fire that could be brought to bear. This is not the late 1980s. This is not the tanker war. This is something entirely different. And the Iranians now know they've got a real strategic asset, more useful than a nuclear weapon. And they've used it. And they don't believe we have an answer for it.
General Clark is referring to, of course, Iran's stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz. In its counter move, the U.S. says it has turned around more than 30 ships since starting its naval blockade last Monday. This week, the Navy also captured two oil tankers associated with the smuggling of Iranian oil. President Trump has announced Israel and Lebanon have agreed to extend a ceasefire between Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah by 3 weeks. The announcement followed direct talks between Tel Aviv and Beirut in Washington. Last week's initial 10-day ceasefire was set to expire on Monday. Rebecca Heinrichs, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, explains how the negotiations between Israel and Lebanon seem to be moving more quickly than those between Iran and the U.S.
because the United States and Israel has been so successful in penetrating the Iran regime in the initial salvo, essentially, of Operation Epic Fury, that the power structure has broken down. It's a different problem with the United States in Iran, where we actually do know who is in charge in Lebanon, and those individuals are negotiating with the Israeli government.
Though the ceasefire has largely held, Israel has continued to strike Hezbollah. Lebanon accused Israel of committing a war crime after one of its strikes in southern Lebanon on Wednesday killed a Lebanese journalist reporting on the war, rattling the truce. Israel said it does not target journalists, and it's investigating the incident. At least 2,300 people have been killed in the strikes on Lebanon since the conflict began anew earlier this year. American military members supporting the war with Iran and others stationed in the U.S. and around the globe are now subject to a new flu vaccine policy. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth made the announcement this week, citing religious freedom. The Defense Department now says service members will no longer be required to receive the annual flu vaccine, in place for seven decades, for reasons of medical autonomy. Military vaccine programs became a contentious political issue during the coronavirus pandemic, when more than 8,000 service members were forced out of the military for refusing to obey a mandate to take the COVID-19 vaccine, many because of religious objections. The new Trump administration crafted a policy to reinstate them with back pay, an issue Hegseth has personally highlighted. Some former military leaders counter that having sick troops in no way enhances military readiness, and that being in a military unit ready to deploy is a group activity. But Hegseth said vaccine mandates are too broad and should be left up to individuals.
Our new policy is simple. If you, an American warrior entrusted to defend this nation, believe that the flu vaccine is in your best interest, then you are free to take it. You should. But we will not force you, because your body, your faith, and your convictions are not negotiable, your health. It's common sense. It's the kind of common sense approach we're undertaking in this department.
The new flu vaccine policy takes effect immediately. Ironically, Hegseth made this video announcement while sitting in front of what appears to be the famous painting called Washington Crossing the Delaware. And it was General George Washington himself who, 250 years ago, mandated inoculations for all soldiers during the Revolutionary War because of the threat of smallpox. In two contentious hearings in front of Senate committees on Wednesday, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. clashed with lawmakers over vaccines and drug prices. It was the first time Kennedy appeared before lawmakers after making dramatic and sudden changes to childhood vaccine schedules. While several Republican senators praised RFK on his work to phase out synthetic food dyes and for investing in rural health, a couple of GOP doctors pressed him on these changes. And some Democratic senators clashed with him on the high price of medications on the federally run website, TrumpRx.
I am a doctor who has seen people die from vaccine preventable diseases. And when I see outbreaks numbering in the thousands and people dying once more from vaccine preventable diseases, particularly children, it seems more than tragic.
They got disagree a better than one out of four chance of paying more at TrumpRx than they would if they went to Costco. That's not much of a deal for the American people.
Not on branded drugs.
Oh, so your answer is Americans should just not take prescription drugs.
We are directing people. We will be directing people to the generics, the cheapest available. But a lot of doctors prescribe the brands, and we're giving them massive reductions in the brands.
Those hearings and 2 weeks of congressional hearings focused on the proposed HHS budget for the 2027 fiscal year. Senator Cassidy also questioned RFK Jr. about why HHS has not yet reinstated a requirement for an in-person doctor's appointment to first obtain abortion pills and restricting the dangerous drugs from being sent in the mail. To the frustration of the Louisiana senator, Kennedy declined to comment. On Monday, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case from Colorado-based Catholic preschools whose leaders say their exclusion from a state school tuition program violates religious freedom. Under a universal preschool program, Colorado provides children with 15 hours per week of free education at a public or private school of their parents' choice. But the program requires preschools to follow non-discrimination laws. And because the Catholic preschools require teachers and parents to align with its Catholic mission, including on sexuality and gender identity, the state has excluded them from the program. Nicholas Reeves, senior counsel for the religious liberty law firm Beckett, is representing the preschools. He's optimistic the high court will side with the Catholic preschools.
The Supreme Court has said on three different occasions that you can't exclude religious individuals like the families here and religious schools from a generally available benefit, which is this universal preschool funding. So if Colorado is going to open up this funding to families and to private schools, what they can't do is only exclude families because of their religious beliefs.
The Archdiocese of Denver and its parish preschools, along with a Catholic couple who had to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket to send their children to a Catholic preschool, filed the lawsuit in 2023. The Supreme Court will likely hear oral arguments for the case in the fall. We'll be right back.
So it's wrenching as a person and as a Chicagoan and, you know, also somebody of the faith to see these buildings squandered. And that's not something that should be done.
The question of church consolidation, closed church buildings, and what to do with property no longer in church use. We visit one former Chicago parish to talk about a fraught issue affecting dioceses across the country. EWTN News in Depth will be right back.
The issue of Catholic Church consolidation, merging parishes and closing churches because of dwindling membership, can be upsetting and emotional for parishioners who love where they attend services. And it's a difficult situation for church leaders responsible for shepherding financial resources and in making those tough decisions. In this Catholic Life Report, Mark Irons examines the complex situation with a visit to Chicago, where some Catholic parishioners are still troubled by the closure of their church from several years ago.
They come to pray regularly at their beloved Catholic church in Chicago. They sit on chairs outside. Going inside isn't possible because this church is boarded up and it's been closed for nearly 7 years.
We're still a community. We have our community. We are the people. Exactly. We're still here.
St. Adelbert Church is standing vacant on 17th Street. Yet, former parishioners like Blanca Torres still gather, light candles, hold rosary beads, and lift up prayers on the sidewalk underneath scaffolding. The parish was first home to Polish immigrants who built this beautiful church more than 100 years ago. It was named after a favorite patron saint and martyr, St. Adelbert. Eventually, Mexican immigrants filled the pews as they flocked to the surrounding Pilsen neighborhood, an area in Chicago with a lively Mexican Catholic presence.
We went to school here. We had all our major things here happen here. Our community was here. The Polish community welcomed my mom with open arms.
Remnants and colors of both the Mexican and Polish heritage that once filled this church with life now sway or stand silent outside. The Archdiocese of Chicago cited major, costly repairs as part of the reason for closing the church in 2019. It's not just happening here. In cities including Baltimore, New Orleans, and St. Louis, once thriving hubs of Catholicism, church officials have had to make tough decisions. They say low mass attendance, priest shortages, financial constraints, and lack of resources have caused some parish consolidations and closures. This month, the Archdiocese of Dubuque in Iowa announced weekend masses will stop at more than 80 churches amid a restructuring plan to merge parishes.
Trying to be authentic with people. Yes, this hurts. Yes, this is scary. Yes, it's different than anything we may have imagined. But Jesus is still good. He still desires salvation through his church to be spread. So what does that look like for us?
Father Aaron Jungi in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, whose parish is affected by the restructuring plan, says even with an ever-changing Catholic landscape across America, faith should remain full of hope.
G.K. Chesterton has this wonderful line that we follow a God who knows his way out of the grave. And so that's why we should never look for the final death of the church. And so this is another moment of Jesus leading us out of what looks like a grave into a new reality.
When a church building does have to close, what's next? How will these once holy spaces be used? And could they still be of service to the faith in new ways? After the last mass inside St. Adelbert, this video was shot by former parishioner Julie Sawicki.
the candle that is continuing to burn despite the closing of the church and its deconsecration.
We continue to see this as a house of worship, a Catholic house of worship, and a house of God.
Sawicki is president of the Society of St. Adelbert, the group formed to preserve and revive this historic complex of buildings, which also includes an old rectory, convent, and school. Sawicki says they want to retain the spiritual character of these buildings. The group has proposed transforming this into a shrine with a retreat house to generate revenue.
For this enormous Polish community that was here on this side of the city, this was for us our St. Peter's Basilica. This was our cathedral.
The Archdiocese of Chicago still owns these church buildings and property. 7 years have passed with no sale, but there have been some interested buyers. From a non-denominational Christian church to a developer who once turned a synagogue in Miami to an event space that could be used in part for same-sex weddings. Sawicki claims the Society of St. Adelbert has the needed funds to purchase this property. Eric Wolin, the Chief Capital Assets Officer for the Archdiocese, told us the Archdiocese would consider any serious offer on the property and acknowledged any proposal should be respectful of the previous sacred site. The nonprofit, non-religious group Preservation Chicago, advocating for historic buildings in the city, added St. Adelbert to its annual list of most endangered buildings years ago.
This church and this complex of buildings, you know, means so much to this community. It is a cornerstone of the community. It may be deconsecrated, but that doesn't make it any less important.
Ward Miller is the executive director. He worked alongside former parishioners to secure landmark status for the church, which means in part it's protected from demolition.
You know, I think we've learned from the community that this is a sacred space.
And that's obvious from those that still meet up here weekly.
When the sun goes down on this shuttered parish, the prayers are lifted up by those who still call this place home.
Among some, there's still frustration that this church was closed in the first place.
What is your hope for this building?
We want it reopened. There was no reason.
Anina Jacobowski's mother was a loyal member of this parish, and she calls the church a gift from the Polish people to the city of Chicago.
This is also part of my heritage.
Isn't it just culture. A building?
Oh, now you sound like the bishop I talked to. Honey, why are you attached to brick and mortar? I said to him, do you not go home to your brick and mortar house to see your family?
For some, like Dahlia Radecki, this now boarded up brick and mortar remains a battered holy site worth visiting, named after a saint worth calling upon.
St. Adelbert is, you know, a patron to all these people here. Look at them.
The fight to revive St. Adelbert into something these parishioners could be proud of will continue. What's next for this building is still in question. But perhaps more importantly, what's next for the people across America who experience a parish closure? Will they continue practicing their faith at another Catholic church?
Why do you still come to this closed church?
Because this has been our church.
Isn't it time to find a different church home?
No. We're going to fight till the end.
Many might be struggling with the loss of their particular faith community.
We have to sit with them, listen, receive that grief, but then not allow it to become a black hole, and instead go, okay, so what more is Jesus looking to give?
Though there are some closed Catholic churches, there are far more open ones where the sacraments, a key part of Catholic life, continue to be available, such as the Eucharist and confession. Father Jungi says the sacraments provide concrete assurances of the presence of Jesus Christ.
We can never, ever abandon our faith just because a building or a community are no longer accessible to us in the way that they were before. And in some ways, it would be like continuing to go to the empty tomb when we know that our Lord is risen.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
A complex situation to be sure for all involved. We'll keep a close eye on parish closures or mergers around the country and have more about the reuse of church property. And this note, Mark's report this week was timely. Thursday happened to be the feast day of St. Adelbert. St. Adelbert, pray for us.
And finally today, as we close, back to the historic and consequential trip Pope Leo just wrapped up to Africa. Amid the outreach to millions of Catholics on the continent, among the most touching of moments was when our Holy Father embraced children. We share highlights now in our Images of the Week. Let the children come to me. Beautiful. Our thanks to the EWTN News Vatican Bureau for compiling that video essay. That's it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Next week at this time, we'll be providing you a news special, Pope Leo's Peru, taking a look at the life and times of then Bishop Robert Prevost in South America, years that helped to shape a papacy. That as we anticipate the one-year anniversary on May 8th of our Holy Father's elevation to the throne of St. Peter. Pope Leo's Peru, you won't want to miss it. Until we see you again 2 weeks from now, God bless.